Good afternoon, Justice Holland, and may it please the court. I'm here on behalf of Chaka Madre, who was convicted of a controlled substance offense and weapons offenses in the Superior Court. The issue here is the sufficiency of the evidence for the defendant's convictions of firearms offenses. And the essential facts insofar as the firearms offense were that two firearms were found within a locked security box in a closet in the defendant's bedroom when the police executed a search warrant there. Now, I just want to clarify one thing, says right away. In the state's brief, it was perhaps there was some ambiguity there, but I thought at first when I read the state's brief said that there were drugs and paraphernalia found in the closet. I believe it said that there were drugs. The firearms were found in a safe in the defendant's closet where paraphernalia and drugs were found. Actually, there were no paraphernalia or drugs in the, to clarify that ambiguity, there were no paraphernalia or drugs in the closet. It was only the locked box on the top shelf of the closet.
Where were the drugs?
The drugs were, there was a bag containing 3 to 4 grams of cocaine on the top of a dresser in the bedroom, and there was also a bag containing a little less than 1 gram on the top of the dresser, and there was, the police found a bag containing a less than a gram underneath the mattress, it says in the house.
And so this was all in his bedroom?
Yes.
And it was the closet of his bedroom where the gun was
in the
safe. Yes,
yes. And we don't contest, and it was admitted at trial, that the drugs and paraphernalia were his. However, he disclaimed that the firearms, says, were his. And we contend that there was insufficient evidence.
Was there any evidence of anyone else sharing the bedroom?
Well, apparently there was a woman and a child in the bedroom. At the same time, an adult woman and child, young child, 2 to 4 years old, in the bedroom at the same time. Of course, the child didn't possess it, says the firearms. And there's no evidence one way or the other as to whether, says the woman, was in possession of anything. That's neither here nor there in the sense that she wasn't charged with any controlled substance offenses. He said the controlled substance offenses were his. It's not clear from the record what the relationship between the, what, if any, relationship between there was between the man and the woman.
But the three of them occupied the room every day?
We don't know from the record.
But your position is the fact that the guns were locked in a box in the closet was not simply a question of fact for the jury to consider, but the fact that the guns were locked in a box in a closet and whatever else you're going to tell us, as a matter of law, required those charges to be dismissed and not submitted to the jury.
Yes, that's what we're contending. As in Mack and as in Gardner, where this court decided that although the jury convicted the defendants Gardner and Barnett in those cases, there was nonetheless insufficient evidence to find those defendants guilty of firearms offenses.
How significant, if at all, is it to your argument that the guns were locked into a box for which there was no key found? Would it make any difference if the police found a key somewhere in the house or in the bedroom?
It would make a difference if there was a key found, for instance, in our client's pocket to the locked box. That could make a great deal of difference. Perhaps I wouldn't be arguing that there was insufficient evidence, and there's probably a very
What I'm trying to get at is how significant is the key aspect to it? This was a locked safe of some sort, and the key couldn't be found.
We believe it's very significant. It was a factor that the court considered significant in Barnett versus State, where a firearm was also found in a locked box in a closet, says outside of the defendant's bedroom. So we believe that's very significant. I was thinking of analogies, and let's say there are a male and female occupying this bedroom, and for instance, if I had if my wife had a locked box on top of the closet in our bedroom, or even yet if your spouse had a locked box, it's on the in the closet in the bedroom. It's entirely possible that the other spouse doesn't know what the contents of the locked box are. It could be passport. It could be keepsakes from your spouse's family, a grandmother's birth certificate or immigration papers, whatever. It could be, we don't know always what's within the contents of a locked box. So we can speculate that either I or Your Honors know what are the contents of a locked box in, but that speculation isn't proof that we know.
Okay, but I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, but help us parse the rule of law you're advocating. If you look at Barnett, we have a closet and a locked box, but the closet is not in the same room with the drugs. Now, here we have the closet and the locked box in the same bedroom with the drugs, and then you seem to make a distinction about whether a key was available, and you seem to suggest, you know, if the key was in this case, if there was a key on a little hook in the closet, then maybe that would be dispositive of the case. But putting all these facts together about lock boxes, closets, same closet as the room with the drugs, not the same closet, the availability of a key or not, how do we reconcile all of that into a rule of law?
Well, the rule of law is that if the defendant did not have accessibility to the locked box by way of a key, if he didn't have access to a key because no key was found, under the circumstances where one would have to break open, says the locked box, it's not readily accessible.
What if there's a combination lock?
That might be different, but we'd have to again speculate that anyone in the house or the apartment or the bedroom knew the combination to that lock, and that's speculation. If it's a different case, but if the defendant had in his wallet a piece of paper that had what looked like a combination, and the police officers, as so often they often do, they ring cell phones, try to look, it opens the box, that's really damning evidence that it's he belongs to the contents of the locked box.
All right. I'd like to get back to the idea of a rule of law here because there are probably an infinite variety of factors that could or could not exist with respect to the type of the safe and where it's located and so on. The statute talks about physically available or accessible. And you're saying that if there's no key, it can't be physically available or accessible. Is that correct?
The evidence isn't sufficient to establish beyond reasonable doubt that that's so. Now, there may be other evidence. Maybe the defendant admitted that he has a key in the car.
All right, let's stick with one thing at a time here. So is it your position that if it's a locked box of some sort and the state is unable to find a key and the defendant, nobody makes any admissions that, yes, I have a key or that's my safe, then as a matter of law, that's a case that cannot go to the jury?
Yes, I believe so.
Under what?
Under Barnett and Gardner. We're under similar, analogous circumstances. It was considered not to be accessible. The requirement of proof of control, dominion or control, is more for possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony than it is for simple possession. The court made that clear in Mack versus State in 1973.
So you think that there's no distinction to be drawn between a case where the box is in a separate room in the house from the rest of the criminal conduct evidence versus a case where the box is in a location that is the same location as other evidence of criminal activity?
I don't think so. In Barnett, the locked box was found in a linen closet outside the bedroom. Now, there was only evidence that there were two people living in the apartment, the defendant Barnett and his mother. And there was no evidence that there was even a closet in Barnett's bedroom. So, under those circumstances, this case is more like, says Barnett, that the real, to excuse the pun, the key factor here is that there was a lock. The firearms were contained within a locked box for which there was no proof of accessibility, and accessibility is the key, so to speak, because accessibility, a gun right outside a bedroom in a linen closet is more accessible than a gun, than a firearm that's contained within a locked box, which apparently, according to all the evidence, is inadmissible to the person you've charged with control over the contents of that locked box.
Well, can't inferences be drawn of accessibility if, let's say, this, for example, or was there evidence that everything on the shelf next to the locked box belonged to the defendant? Or if the defendant had initials, his initials were on the locked box? I mean, aren't there ways to draw inferences as to accessibility?
That may be a different case, but again, there's evidence as opposed to supposition there. The defendant's initials on the locked box, that's evidence that supports the inference that it's his locked box. Just because it's there doesn't support the inference that it's his.
But what was in the closet?
I don't know that it's in the record, what was in the closet. Maybe clothing, maybe whatever, but, you know, again, that something is located. The question of accessibility during the commission of the offense is controlled by the question of accessibility. As the court made clear, it's accessibility. It's not proximity. It's accessibility. So if there is a safe, it says underneath here, containing a firearm, or let's say underneath the lectern here, there's a safe, and it has a combination or a lock to it, and it's proximate to me, I'm near it, I'm very near it, does it mean the contents are accessible to me? I don't think so.
Would you be asking us to make a new rule of law then, that if there's a locked box, as long as there's no key, it's not accessible to any defendant?
No, I'm not asking for that at all, Justice Berger. I'm arguing that this case is, the facts of this case are analogous to both Barnett and to Barnett particularly, and also says Gardner, where the lack of accessibility to the firearm was a crucial factor in determining that there was insufficient evidence of accessibility to the firearm.
So you're saying here that if you take all of the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, there's no evidence of accessibility at all because it's locked, there's no key, and there's no inference you can make from any other evidence, direct or circumstantial, that connects the defendant to the box.
Correct.
If all the drugs and everything, all the contraband mm-hmm. was in this safe, mm-hmm. In the defendant's bedroom, mm-hmm. and no key can be found, but it's everybody concedes or mm-hmm. there's proof it's his bedroom, his closet. There can be no conviction of even possession under that circumstance.
Well, their possession again is a less requiring standard. Possession of a controlled substance has a less requiring standard of proof, less demanding standard of proof than possession of a firearm. We're not talking about possession. We're talking about, with respect to possession of a firearm, it's not just possession, it's accessibility.
I can be convicted of possession of the drugs, but not the firearm?
Yes. Yes, for instance, there could be in a closet or the public defender's office across the street, there could be a controlled substance.
I mean, my hypothetical where all the drugs and the guns are in the same lockbox.
Mm-hmm.
That scenario would allow for a possession of the drugs conviction, but not for the firearms conviction.
Most certainly.
Well, in this case, wasn't he also charged with possession of a gun by a person prohibited?
Yes, he was.
Now, and based on what you've been telling us in the last few minutes, you would seem to suggest that the gun wasn't accessible for purpose of that charge, but is your position that he could be convicted of possession of the gun in the lockbox by a person prohibited? Or that conviction would fall also?
We believe it's also insufficient. We're relying on Barnett that there isn't sufficient proof of possession by a person prohibited, although the standard for possession by a person prohibited is broader than possession of a firearm during commission of a felony, because the definition of possession by a person prohibited permits conviction for purchasing, owning, possessing, or controlling. For instance, you can be convicted of possession by a person prohibited even if you don't possess the weapon.
So, for example, if we just stretch the hypothetical and the gun was in the kitchen, he could be found guilty of possession by a person prohibited because it's his gun, his house, and we'll assume there's circumstantial evidence to support that, and yet not be convicted of having the gun physically accessible to him for purposes of the other conviction.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes.
You have about 4 minutes left.
I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, the police, the court.
Good afternoon, Mr. O'Donnell.
Mr. O'Donnell then just touched on the difference between the concept of possession of the two charges, because there are two very different charges here. One is during the commission of a felony, where the key is accessibility, A. B, during the felony. And the other is possession by a person prohibited, where the gun becomes, in essence, contraband, just like drugs. If you are a person prohibited, you cannot possess in any way, shape, or form a deadly weapon or a gun, especially a firearm. And that firearm could be in a storage locker miles away from your home. But if that's your storage locker and you have access to it, you are still possessing it constructively for purposes of that person prohibited charge. Now, during the commission of a felony is something completely different. The key there is accessibility. As I understand Mr. O'Donnell's argument, he is arguing, A, taking Mr. Madry's denial that he knew anything about the box, that the guns simply weren't his at all. He knew nothing about them. They got there by some other means, and therefore he is not guilty of all the charges, whether during a felony or by a person prohibited. Position two is that, well, they weren't accessible because they were in a locked box, and the police could not find the key, in which case the charge of possession during the commission of a felony fails because of lack of accessibility. But that says nothing about by a person prohibited. Whether, as this court's made clear, it's not possession of a weapon at any particular time, whether it's a time of arrest, as here, or the time of a particular crime, but it's possession at any time in any way, shape, or form.
Well, in this case, what's the evidence in the record that supports a finding of accessibility during the commission of a felony?
That's the continuing felony of possession with intent to deliver. And there was drugs and paraphernalia commonly used for packaging, and the defendant was convicted of that crime. So the during the commission of a felony is not the problem. The problem then becomes, is the gun, which is in the same room as the drugs and presumably the locus of the defendant's drug packaging activities, even though he may not sell from the room. As a matter of fact, the evidence was that he sold from the doorway, the front door of the house. Not enough people didn't go up to the room, they came to the house, but this is where he packaged his drugs for sale. There's the fact that the gun was found in the same room. At the time that the police then search, yes, the guns are in the box and the box is locked and the police can't find a key. But the state's position was it's inferable that at some point during this continuing felony, the defendant, and of course it was the defendant's gun, was the state's position, it's in the closet, and there was testimony from the police at the closet, although there were some female clothes in there indicating that the young lady who was in the room probably also lived there too. The bulk of the clothing, boots, and so on that were in the closet were men's. And there were also some papers there on the shelf that had Chaka Madri's name on it. So this was his closet. Now,
did the shelf have exclusively the defendant's items on it?
I'm sorry?
The shelf that had the safe on it, was that shelf the place or location where only the defendant's things would be found, or were there the woman's things?
I thought that the shelf was in the top, and then there was clothing. The clothing portion, the hanging portion, was under the shelf, a very narrow closet, about so wide. And the lockbox was on the top shelf. The detective was talking about the clothing underneath it. I think it was ambiguous. It's A17 where he talks about the contents here. He did mention tall, skinny closet. You said some paperwork, some items strung on top there as well. It's a little ambiguous. I know there was some of the paperwork containing the defendant's name. I don't recall exactly what they were. So there was some paperwork there, whether it was on the shelf or on the floor. It's just ambiguous. But there is, again, the box on the shelf. This is not a large closet, once again, very small. He said it was a tall, skinny closet. And there is the box. So, the inference we were asking the jury to draw from the evidence here is that the defendant, despite his denial, knew very well what was in that box. The two loaded handguns, and I point out they were loaded, were we argued to the jury, his, and that the defendant, even though the police didn't find the key, nevertheless had access to a key somewhere. It's sort of a plastic storage box, by the way. We're not talking anything major here. And the defendant, if he, had access to the key, and at the turn of the key had access to the box. Therefore, they should find him not only guilty of possession by a person prohibited, which is, Mr. O'Donnell said, a much broader concept of possession, but also that the guns were readily accessible to him during the continuing felony of his drug dealing business. So that was basically the evidence that we put before the jury and before the trial judge. Primarily, accessibility was argued, and the judge, of course, I quoted her decision. She said that's simply a matter for the jury to decide whether the guns were accessible to the defendant during the felony. Of course, if the defendant has the guns accessible, that necessarily implies that he possesses as a person prohibited, even though that doesn't work the other way, since by a person prohibited type of possession is broader than during the commission of a felony.
Could you perhaps assist us in formulating some legal standard that would be able to be applied that can distinguish between the boxes in the room, the boxes outside in the hall, the boxes in the kitchen?
This court
obviously
has.
Obviously, to some extent, every case is going to be determined on its own facts, and everybody has to live with that. But at the same time, it would be helpful if this court were able to explain in terms other than exactly where the box is located, what constitutes being accessible for purposes of sufficient evidence to support a conviction?
As the court said, there are so many different permutations of this, and this court has seen practically all of them. Not quite. This is yet another permutation that comes along. This court has had them locked in the guns and the drugs locked in the trunk of the car. In the Barnett case, it was the lockbox, unloaded gun in the hall linen closet where three other people lived. As I understand Barnett, the decision was there was insufficient evidence that these were the defendant's guns at all. I should point out in Barnett, no drugs were found in the house at all. Mr. Barnett was stopped in a car, and he abandoned the drugs as he ran away. Police then searched his mother's house and found the guns in the hall linen closet. This court said the evidence was insufficient to sustain the conviction both of during the commission of a felony and by a person prohibited. In other words, there was insufficient evidence that these were Barnett's guns to begin with.
But going back to Justice Berger's question, what do we know about the policy or the intent of the statute? You know, one might think that the legislature was trying to prohibit or discourage people from having guns and drugs together because they didn't want the drug transaction to turn into the use of a weapon.
Yes.
So if you look at some of our cases, for example, the shotgun behind the couch,
right,
that would be consistent with such a legislative policy because if you started to have a problem with the drug transaction, you go behind the couch, leap over the couch, grab the gun, and you have the situation the legislature wanted to avoid. But when you have the gun in a locked box and the drug transaction starts to have a problem, you know, it's going to take a little bit of time for someone, even with a key, to unlock whatever it is, get the guns. And so the question is, on this continuum of readily accessible because you have it in your waistband or something versus it's close to you but in a locked box, how do we articulate the legal rule that, or how do we define accessibility?
Well, the court is certainly correct that the legislative policy is to stop a felony from turning violent, to stop gunplay or whatever from happening, and I suppose that should inform every decision. But, I mean, there are many different, again, permutations of this. What about the accessible but unloaded gun? You have to take the time. A number of cases of this court has noted the gun was unloaded but nevertheless sustained the conviction of during a felony because it doesn't take much time to load a gun. Again, it probably takes less time if you have the key to unlock the box and take out the two loaded guns. Both of these were loaded, ready to fire. So it's just such a factual issue in each case. Is the gun, first of all, you know, in the locus of the continuing felonious activity in the case of a continuing crime, or obviously in the, like a robbery or something? Of course, it has to be, you know, after the robbery begins and after it ends. Is it readily accessible? I mean, is there a danger that, say, when Barnett is, where Badgley here, say, is packaging his drugs and somebody barges in, is there a danger he's going to go and grab a gun and this is going to turn into a shootout? So that's, again, as the judge ruled in this case, well, leave that up to the jury. Is the gun readily accessible during the commission of the continuing felony of possession with intent to deliver or drug trafficking, in the common use of that term?
I take it from the way you've been describing it or attempting to describe it that you don't place much emphasis on the evidence of a key or not. In other words, in this case, nobody found the key, but for purposes of determining whether the guns were accessible under the statute, you seem to be suggesting that we should assume the existence of a key or infer the existence of a key, and that therefore it's more a question of how far the guns were from where the other criminal activity would be going on, and whether it is reasonable to assume that they could be accessed if there were a key, and then put to use in the course of the crime.
Yeah, but I'm not really placing any emphasis, unlike my friend Mr. O'Donnell, on the fact that the police never found a key. As I say, it was a plastic storage box, not much bigger than the two guns. That was about all that fit in there, and an envelope with bills that pretty much filled it up. You could use it as a lunchbox. This is not a major safe of any kind. It's
There's $2,000 in cash in it.
$2,000 in cash in an envelope and two pistols. That was the contents of the box.
The envelope have any markings on it?
You know, the only photograph I saw was from above, and I see the money peeking out of the envelope, and the two guns sort of fit in there. So I'm not sure what was on the envelope at all. Maybe just an envelope. I mean, to answer the court's question, I'm not placing a lot of emphasis on the fact that the police were not able to locate a key, and that obviously Mr. Madry was not about to say, oh, I know where the key is. He denied immediately any knowledge of the strong box, although he did accept everything else, all the drugs, the paraphernalia, even baggies found in his mother's coat pocket that he had put there. He said, no, those are mine, too. He just didn't want anything to do with the guns. And, of course, if one accepts his statement, then he is not guilty of anything as far as the weapons go. The state submits that it's clearly inferable from the position of the box in the bed, in the closet, that he's guilty of the person prohibited, the two counts of that. And I think the issue really is joined on whether these two guns were accessible, sufficiently accessible to fulfill the legislative intent behind the during the commission of a felony crime. Again, the judge's decision was, we'll let the jury decide that one. As a matter of law, I am not going to dismiss this charge or these two charges. I think he was only found guilty of one of those, but of both, person prohibited. I wish I could be clearer on the state's position here, but again, this is such a...
Was that a compromise?
I'm sorry?
Was that a compromise verdict on the...
I think the jury saw, quite frankly, biasly saw, look, we have one felony, you know, one count of possession during the felony. However, he did have two guns, and he was prohibited, therefore we'll hit him for both counts of that. You could say jury lenity, but just seemed to me to be jury common sense here more than anything else.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In his remarks, Mr. Donovan emphasized that drug offenses are by their nature continuing offenses, and therefore, I guess, because it's a continuing offense, because of proximity, therefore, the proximity of the gun had to be even closer at some point to a continuing offense, and therefore the defendant is more guilty, and this establishes sufficient proof. Had the state been right about that, I'm scratching my head here, how could Mr. Donovan have lost Gardner and Barnett under those circumstances? Because in each case, the court pointed out that the fact that possession of controlled substances is a continuing offense isn't sufficient to establish proof that possession of a weapon means that it's readily accessible during the commission of a felony. In Gardner, the court said that drug possession was continuous in the case was insufficient. There was no suggestion that the safety of the arresting officers was at risk by the presence of guns in the residence once Gardner had been placed in custody outside the residence. That's an important factor.
Could this jury infer from the evidence that this box with the two weapons in it and the $2,000 in cash, that when the defendant was, quote, open for business, that box was basically the cash register, or where the cash was kept and where the protection, the weapons were kept for purposes of the drug sales that would happen, and therefore the weapons were accessible under that scenario?
They could have inferred that, and that's what the jury inferred in both Gardner and Barnett. But it still was not sufficient. And insofar, I thought I heard Mr. Donovan mention that it was a plastic storage box. There's nothing in the record that suggests that this was a plastic storage box. It had to be broken open by the police officers with tools. And in addition, the state said that in Barnett, no drugs were found in the house. But in Barnett, the defendant had just left the apartment with the drugs in his backpack. So if it's a continuous offense, why wasn't Barnett found guilty?
Well, can the cases be distinguished based on the location of the where the weapon was found?
No, I don't think so at all. If the court pointed out that there was a conviction of one but not the other firearm, that's hard to explain because the conviction of one but not the other, what does that have to do with accessibility? Now, I'd just like to point out one other detail that hasn't been brought up before, and I hope I'm not stepping off a cliff. I don't think the fact was relevant, but there was testimony at trial that there was a DNA comparison on the two firearms, and there was a mixed sample of DNA, produced DNA from our client on one firearm, says, but not the other. The state didn't argue that in their closing argument. The defense brought it up. We can believe it is not relevant because it has nothing to do with accessibility. Your DNA can be found on all kinds of objects far removed from where you are presently, and doesn't mean that the object it's found on is readily accessible to you at the time of the offense. So we don't believe that was critical or even relevant.
But it could explain the verdict.
Yes, juries do funny things.
Thank you both very much. The court will take this matter under advisement and adjourn.
Thank you.